Thank you very much. So I'd like to talk to you today about some of the work that I did for my dissertation at the University of Florida, in particular work under Ramesh Reddy and Ben Turner, who's here today. I'd like to start quickly by mentioning the money. Thank you very much to all these people. In particular, the Amherst facility, which was very generous in their support of the NMR data I'm representing to you today. So hopefully everyone appreciates the role of phosphorus in wetlands, but if you don't, a quick overview. Phosphorus is an amazing element and a very important, I believe, most important element around, but I'm biased. It's implicated in both large-scale and small-scale spatial variability across the landscape, and it's implicated in both biodiversity in cases of low phosphorus here in the Everglades, and also in cases of eutrophication. Here's a picture of cattail in South Florida, where excess phosphorus has been implicated in this shift to a monodominant cattail stand. So phosphorus is known to be very important in wetlands, and the general consensus is that organic phosphorus, or phosphorus from biological sources, is the major player within wetland systems for various reasons I haven't really got time to go into. But a brief look at the literature, this is a quick overview of 117 wetlands where people actually categorically say this is a number for the organic phosphorus in a wetland. Kind of backs this up, that in the lower panel there where we have marsh type systems, the percentage of total phosphorus that is considered organic is high. Around 60-70% is the average that is considered. Now, there are various issues with operationally defined organic phosphorus that we can talk about later. But we haven't really got time now. So what I'd like to say is, as was said by Potter and Benton, the forms of phosphorus that are entering soils, and wetlands in particular, are biologically derived, and due to the fact that you have high organic matter content as a generalisation within wetlands, organic phosphorus is the forms that are seen to dominate. The technique that I have applied in a lot of my work is nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, which allows us to identify the actual functional forms of phosphorus found within these wetlands. So to the latter end of that statement there, where we can now, it's a technique which allows us to address the latter end of that statement, where we can now start to track and look at the forms of phosphorus within soil and wetlands in particular. Brief overview of NMR spectroscopy. The forms that you can identify are many and varied. Again, we can talk about this after the session if anyone would care to get more information. But you can start to tease out the actual the functional forms of phosphorus found within soils, which becomes very important when we start to consider the stability in the environment, the potential for biological turnover, and the implications upon phosphorus biogeochemistry in general. The technique has been applied to many wetlands before I came along. I hate to admit it, but it's true. And there's been a lot of work in late sediments, both in Europe and in China. And in particular, that's focused a lot on the role of polyphosphates within settling sestine and lake sediments. Within more marsh-type systems, which were the kind of systems I was interested in, there's been an awful lot of work in high organic matter systems within South Florida, calcareous usually, but usually very high organic matter. And there's been a smattering of other wetlands studied to date, including billabongs, peat bogs, and Carolina bays. But the general consensus when you look at the literature is that there's a few choice examples which are highly different and have very distinct characteristics, but we don't know whether that is representative of wetlands in general or just these particular sites. I'll briefly talk about some of the aspects identified in past studies. One of the things of particular interest is the ratio found within the organic phosphorus pool of the phosphomonoester to phosphodiesters. Here are some numbers pulled from the literature of the ratio between this phosphomonoester to phosphodiester ratio. And if you can't read, here's some nice pretty pictures to appreciate. I hope you can appreciate that this peak here, which represents the DNA, is a lot larger within the organic system. Within the highly organic water conservation area, Area 1. So we have this notion that wetlands are somehow distinct. They have this high proportion of phosphodiesters within them, but the sites studied to date have been quite limited. So I approached this this work I'm going to be presenting today was an attempt to expand up the scope of wetlands studied to look at whether the generalizations seen here were applicable to all wetlands. And the way you do this is you convince people to send you samples from across the world. And I collected samples from both tropical systems, but also temperate, subtropical, and boreal systems. They represented a range of hydrologies, a range of vegetation types. We had high altitude paramo systems, we had Alaskan bogs, Carolina bays, and such like. Obviously, when dealing with such a diverse range of wetlands, you need to, and I will admit it, a very opportunistic data set there, you need to start to tease apart the potential groupings that you can start to analyze the data on the basis of. And so what I found was that actually I do apologize, I put this in just to give you some background information on the analysis that was carried out on these wetlands. So very simple characterization and biogeochemical characterization of the soils. And then I was using this solution, 31P nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, to study the forms of phosphorus found. Sorry, the groupings that I mentioned, I found that a very simple grouping based on the pH and the organic matter content within wetlands provided a very nice characterization of the wetlands studied into four distinct groupings, high organic, low organic, and high pH, low pH. And this provided the basis to then start to analyze the composition seen within the wetlands to see whether there are any trends and generalizations that could be made. To show you some data, here's a typical Group A wetlands. This is the high organic matter content, low pH, and here's the spectra that comes out of it. You'll see to the right here the fact that there are polyphosphates, there's pyrophosphates, DNA, and such like. And here's a picture of that wetland to show you, give you sort of an idea of what we're dealing with here. Cattail, relatively low phosphorus levels, ombrotrophic peat bog. That's the same wetland at night. I can convince people not to go sampling if someone wants 24-hour sampling of gas. It's not fun in a wetland. Again, Group B wetlands, these are the low pH but slightly low organic matter. Compared to the terrestrial systems, we're still dealing in a high organic matter system, but in comparison and on the breakdown of my wetlands, this was considered a low organic matter system. And I hope you will see that the composition within this spectrum is very vastly different. We have phosphonates present here, and less polyphosphates, but we also have a whole host of peaks within here which represent a various range of phosphomonoesters. I'm going to skip across the Group C and Group D wetlands, but I hope you'll take away from that there are distinct characteristics that can be seen within those wetlands. In a very qualitative way, you can look at the spectra and say, okay, this seems to be distinct from that. But I needed a way of characterizing them in a more precise fashion. And so what I applied was a PCA analysis, looking at just phosphorus composition determined by the nuclear magnetic resonance in the soil spectra, in the soil sample. And I hope you can see that certain groupings of these very coarse groupings of the wetlands appear to pull out in that they appear to have distinct compositions as from the rest of the wetland types. I haven't got as much time to go into the details of this, but one thing I'd like to talk to you about is the characteristics seen with changing organic matter content. As I mentioned before, highly organic matter wetlands studied within South Florida appear to have a very distinct signature in having a large amount of phosphodiesters. These are things like DNA, RNA, etc. Well, when you actually plot the ratio between the phosphomonoesters, which represent a host of simple chemicals, to this phosphodiester ratio, we can see actually quite a strong correlation with organic matter content, negative correlation with organic matter content. And it appears to be that the wetlands studied to date and talked about in the literature are usually these high organic matter content systems that are represented down here. But if you find yourself dealing with a wetland with a lower organic matter content, this ratio actually shifts towards a more terrestrial type signature. What becomes interesting is that actually if you start to model this by general linear models, other factors appear to become important within this ratio of the phosphomonoesters to phosphodiesters. In particular, the C to P ratio, so the phosphorus availability within that system, appears to show some significant effect upon the composition of that ratio. So there appears to be that there are basic biogeochemical characteristics which are dictating and dictating the composition of phosphorus found within the soil. And one thing of particular interest that I'd like to talk to you about, these systems here, which represent relatively low organic matter content, is the presence of inositol hexokinase phosphate. This is a form of organic phosphorus that has been identified in many terrestrial systems and has been talked about as potentially present in certain wetlands, but generally is considered not to be stable under anaerobic wetland conditions. It has been found in stream sediments, but very rarely has it been found in significant quantities within wetlands. Some of these study sites I've been finding, including the Carolina Bays within South Carolina and North Carolina, actually contain very large quantities of these very stable organic phosphorus forms. These are forms of phosphorus that are considered very recalcitrant in nature. That is up for debate at the moment. But what it represents is that we have something unique within these wetlands, either the characteristics of this wetland type or the potential sources of organic phosphorus, that means that they have a unique signature as compared to the highly organic matter content wetlands that have been studied in South Florida. Again, if anyone would care to discuss this afterwards, I'm more than happy. So it's been a bit of a brief run through, but in conclusion, I'd like to say that there have been a range of phosphorus forms seen in wetlands that I've studied to date, and including significant concentrations of polyphosphates within these marsh-type systems. Up to 15% of the total phosphorus within the soil is found as these inorganic polyphosphates, which are long chains of phosphate monomers bound together with acid anhydride bonds. Large quantities of inositol hexokinase phosphate found within certain wetlands, and a whole host of other compounds that I wasn't able to discuss today. The simple groupings that I used here in terms of the organic matter content and the pH was shown to have seemingly some driving effect upon the composition. And if we start to tease that apart by looking at both phosphorus availability and organic matter content, there appears to be some interplay between them, as I said here. And the certain functional forms, including the polyphosphates, appear to be linked to the microbial biomass seen within the wetlands. Again, I wasn't able to show you that data today. So I hope you will take from this that it offers a very powerful technique that allows you to look at the phosphorus composition within wetland soils, but it needs to be applied with caution, and certainly the application of past experiences within certain wetlands to novel systems needs to be with a certain amount of care. With that, I'd like to take any questions, and thank you for your time.
What did you consider low organic matter? What was the
division,
low versus high?
That's a very good point. So again, it is all relative. And so within these sites, the groupings are descriptively called low organic. But actually, I think the cutoff within the Ward's hierarchical classification was 40% organic matter. So still relatively high organic matter.
Sorry. I was wondering if the ratio of mono to diester tells you anything functional about soil. For example, is it a reflection of degree of carbon mineralization or anything along those lines?
Right. Well, it's an interesting point, and I'd say yes, it is to a certain degree. I mean, the general sort of belief is that the types of monoesters, phosphomonoesters that were being found in some of these lower organic matter content systems are highly recalcitrant. So these are forms of phosphorus that have been potentially there for some time, have just been accumulating with time. So it could give you an indication of carbon turnover. The trouble with all of this analysis is that the NMR was done on gross soil, and we weren't able to partition out the microbial population versus that which was in the sort of the dead organic matter. And that's one major limitation of the technique, because I'm able to tell you whether the DNA we see in these high organic matter systems represents DNA stabilized in the extracellular environment, or whether it represents just a higher microbial content. And so it can start to begin to get at some of those questions, but I think the application needs to be more careful. That makes sense.
One quick one. Do you have any idea to which extent the alkaline extraction might change your results and result in biases, or will it be larger for the acidic wetlands than for the alkaline ones?
That's a very good point. And so the extraction method I used was a simple single-step extraction with sodium hydroxide and EDTA. And if you go to the literature, there's a lot of questions raised about whether a pre-extraction to get rid of the iron content and such like has an effect. And what was interesting was that the high polyphosphates that I found in some of the wetlands, up to 15% of the total phosphorus within the wetland soil, were in sites with low overall iron content. And one potential bias is the fact that polyphosphates are hydrolyzed under alkaline conditions by divalent cations. And so there's this potential issue that in certain situations where you have low, in ombrotrophic systems where you have low metal content, you could be sort of artificially inflating the role of polyphosphates because they are present in other wetlands, we're just not capturing them with this technique. And there are methods that apply pre-extractions to try and isolate the polyphosphates in particular. So the short answer is yes, they would have some effect. Unfortunately, I'm unable to tell you what they would be in these systems.
Okay.